Hello and welcome back to the Western Bubble. My name is Dario Hasenstab and I'm here with Balder Hagritz. And we are basically live as we are recording this episode today on the Eurovision Song Contest, because we're recording it on Sunday, one day after it happened. Balder, why are you so angry and why are we recording about the Eurovision Song Contest?
I wouldn't say I'm that angry, Dario, but good to be here again. No, we were actually planning to record something else for today. And then before, as we always do, we have a little chat before recording and we started talking about Eurovision. Apparently, you are a big fan and I'm not so much a fan, but since my son is old enough last year, we've been watching it last year and this year again. And this year has been quite a dramatic Eurovision contest. And so this episode is not really about a fun music event, but more about the problems surrounding it regarding the EBU, the institution organizing Eurovision, versus the people, which is a nice sort of analogy or certainly symmetrical to the institutional problems you see elsewhere in the West. And the relationship between the West and Israel, which was a big deal in this contest as well this year. So essentially, usually Eurovision would be a lighthearted topic. Today, it's not so much a lighthearted topic, but a more serious analysis of how this shows some of the problems that Europe and the West and Israel are facing.
And what are the facts?
The Eurovision Song Contest, often known simply as Eurovision, is an international song competition organized annually by the European Broadcasting Union. Each participating country submits an original song to be performed live and transmitted to national broadcasters via the Eurovision and Euroradio networks, with competing countries then casting votes for the other country's songs to determine a winner. The Eurovision Song Contest 2024 was the 68th edition of the Eurovision Song Contest. The Netherlands was disqualified from the contest between the second semi-final and the final, but the country retained its right to vote. The inclusion of Israel among the participants in the context of the Israel-Hamas war was met with controversy and additional security measures were put in place for the event.
What is the bubble?
As you mentioned in the intro, I'm very much a big fan of Eurovision, right? Because I always enjoy the lighthearted nature of it. But as an international relations student, I very much read between the lines and I see all the politics going on, right? So for the more international audience of the Western Bubble, maybe, right, there's this intense vote. I mean, there's basically 1.5 hours of singing. Everyone presents their song. And then an intense voting period starts where everyone gets to vote for each other's countries. And then there is a jury voting involved, right, where each country basically presents their votes from the jury. And that's always hilarious to watch because you see neighboring countries kind of giving each other suspiciously high points. You see countries that really don't like each other and that never receive any points. And that always is a very representative of basically the times we live in, right? So you had the European, like, right, the Euro crisis of 2012. That's when Germany never received any votes, because particularly not from Greece. And that was, right, it's somewhat lighthearted, entertaining to watch. And then you have, I don't know, 2 years ago, right after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it was clear from the get-go that Ukraine would win and so on and so forth. So it's a very, like, as an international relations student, it's very, very interesting event to watch, particularly together with your peers. And it's just a big, nice party and usually very lighthearted.
Yeah, in many ways, it's a good indication of the zeitgeist, using your language here, of the moment, right? It's very much, it shows where the average European is a little bit in their perspective towards the world, certainly with Ukraine, for example. But it is an indicator of dynamics of the moment. And that does make it very, very interesting. From my perspective, I don't know, I've always found it a bit of, you know, a chore to have to listen to all those songs and to spend hours watching that, even though it's only once a year. But since my son is into it, I've started doing it again. And it's, yeah, I guess it's kind of fun.
Mm. For me, it's a lot of fun. However, this year was different, as you already teased, and as I already explained in the fact sheet. Because of the whole situation surrounding Israel and Gaza, there was already a lot of debate, a lot of controversy, basically at the beginning of this whole process, right? Because obviously each country selects their song months in advance through very complicated processes in the national broadcasting unions. And Israel basically started by submitting a song about the attacks of October 7th. Right. So when radicals and terrorists from Hamas from Gaza onto Israel, right, launched the October 7th attack, killing about 1,000 people, a little bit more than that. And Israel submitted a song about that, which, according to Eurovision rules, Eurovision is basically a non-political event, an apolitical event. It wasn't allowed, right? So Israel basically had to submit another song that wasn't about this topic, that was less political.
Yeah, and they have been relatively consistent about that within the event itself, right? So you also, for example, can't hold a speech about peace, even though everyone would agree that peace is a good thing, I would hope, but they've been quite clear throughout the years that you're not supposed to introduce politics into the event itself. The only problem that the EBU, the organizing organization behind Eurovision, has here is that they banned Russia after the invasion of Ukraine. And that, of course, is a political statement. Now, you might agree with it and you might say, yeah, Russia should be banned for invading another sovereign country. And of course, we're going to support Ukraine in this. Okay, fine. But the decision to ban Russia and Belarus as an ally to Russia in the war against Ukraine is a political decision. So then the moment you take that decision, the moment you take the decision to ban a country, then you make yourself vulnerable to criticism. Like, hey, if you're banning this country, why aren't you banning that country? And then you have to get into a conversation about what the difference is between Russia and Israel, for example, in 2024. And that's where they already kind of made their own life difficult.
Very difficult. And then particularly in the last week before the event, more and more reports came out of there being some difficulties backstage, right, between different groups. So Israel basically said, hey, we're being treated unfairly here, and a lot of the other delegations are being rude towards us. They started filming that. Then they also started filming their own provocation towards other delegations. And you kind of already had this iffy feeling a week before that this is not going to end nice, because, I mean, the Eurovision crowd is a very open and tolerant crowd, one might say, right? So it's more on the left side of the spectrum, particularly the people in the stadium. It's very queer-friendly and so on and so forth. And that community in particular is known for being, right, very much on the side of free Palestine, right, very much on the pro-Palestinian side, and critical towards the behavior of Israel here. So you already had a lot of tensions backstage.
Yeah, and that's clear, right? So even if Europe is partially divided on Israel and Gaza, and as a whole, the continent doesn't really have a clear position, it is absolutely true that the hardcore followers of Eurovision, the people who make up the backbone of the whole event, certainly, if you like, are more on the pro-Palestinian side. And that meant that the moment that Israel was allowed to compete in the event, there you were basically asking for this kind of reaction. Now, whether it's the right decision or not to let Israel compete, that's not up to me, but it is certainly clear that the moment they said, yes, Israel can continue to compete despite the violence happening in Gaza, then you knew that things were going to become difficult.
And things did become difficult, right? So, as I mentioned, there were then these videos from the Israeli delegation, also from some Israeli journalists, being just, again, being very uncomfortable, very provocative towards others. And then particularly the Dutch delegation and the Dutch artist, Joost Klein, got very involved there, because there was this press conference, right, where there was a question being asked to the Israeli contestant, whether she believes that her presence here at Eurovision would be a danger to other contestants. And then he basically made a comment over towards her because he was at the same press conference, and then covered his face with the Dutch flag. And right, so there, to the normal viewer, it's just like, oh, guys, stop being so childish. Please just do your press conference and tell everyone that you're happy to be here performing.
Yeah, and I must admit that until that moment, I wasn't really following. I was aware of the tensions that existed, but I wasn't really following Eurovision that closely. I was aware, by the way, that this Dutch entry this year was particularly big in the Netherlands. I don't live in the Netherlands anymore, but of course I still read Dutch media and all that. And it, you know, it's clear that the entry this year was kind of culturally, nationally important to the Netherlands. They felt it was very close to their heart and very close to their being.
I can tell you he was a crowd favorite. I remember the first time I heard his song, right, for the audience, it was Europapa, right? Basically a song about no borders and peace and love. And it was very catchy and a bit crazy, as Eurovision is. So it was definitely a crowd favorite. And I imagine a lot of Dutch people are very excited to maybe have a chance at winning Eurovision this year.
Yeah, and more so than other years, right? In the sense that it seemed to really touch a kind of some kind of nerve in the Netherlands. And it was like a really big deal for the Dutch. And the moment that the press conference happened, that's the moment that I started paying a little bit more attention to it all, because I very quickly became very confused about the way that the Israeli delegation went about this. Just as someone who understood that there was this tension, but knowing that Israel, to put it mildly, is a controversial topic at the moment because of the violence. There is real violence happening. Over 30,000, maybe 35,000 civilians have died because of Israeli military action over the past 6 months. That is horrible destruction, any way you put it. You know, regardless of how you justify it or not justify it, that is horrific destruction. Over 15,000 children died. So if you are the Israeli delegation to Eurovision, then your approach to your presence there surely should be, how can we be the nicest, warmest, peace-loving, kindest delegation around? How can we reduce the tension? How can we show the world that we are normal people, that we're not psychopaths? And instead, they seem to be very combative. They seem to be very aggressive against people who were critical of Israel. They were very aggressive against the Dutch delegation. There were these videos showing up of them taking videos. So a video of them taking videos of the Dutch delegation, despite the Dutch asking not to be filmed. And I thought, Israel, what are you doing here? You're supposed to now be practical about the reality that you live in. The world is on the fence. A lot of people are really angry with you. You need to now be clever about this. And instead, they kind of reaffirmed the worst feelings that some people already had about Israel.
See, I would say that this is the moment where very experienced Western bubble listeners will already notice what we're doing here, right? That we're using this individual case, right, and the individual psychology of the Israeli delegation and basically applying the Western bubble concept to that, because it's exactly how countries behave. And I absolutely agree with you, right? Because from a PR standpoint, Israel did everything correctly from the get-go, right? So you want to send a young woman, right, who could theoretically gain all the sympathies of the world, be very nice, just perform a very nice song, and basically say, here, hello, we are Israel, we are a normal, non-aggressive country. And then instead, what happens is that Israel, to me, seems so entrenched in their us versus the rest thinking and us versus these people who are against us and pro, aka by being pro-Palestine, they are being anti-Israel, that they got into this thinking, into this mode of thinking that, okay, now we need to show the world how anti they are towards us, and that will get us a lot of sympathies. And this probably worked with the crowd, let's say part of the middle, right, that's already on the pro-Israel side or that's already has sympathies towards Israel. But I think that maybe someone who is not on either fence, but right in the middle, I don't know, at least I would have the feeling that this has to be perceived very aggressive, right? Holding a phone into someone else's face and basically being like, why are you against me? That comes across very aggressive.
And mocking them. And like also it comes across as juvenile, but it comes across as someone that is not like, you are not likable if you do that. If you hold a phone in someone else's face and that person asks, could you please not film me, and you continue filming, then that makes you not likable. And Eurovision was exactly the kind of platform that Israel should have used to say, hey, we are likable people. We are kind people. We are warm people. We don't like killing Palestinians. We feel in our mindset that it's necessary to eradicate terrorism or whatever. I'm sort of trying to paraphrase Israeli positions here, not necessarily my own position. But we feel that unfortunately we don't have a choice, but we are normal people just like you. And instead, they just came across as juvenile, rather unpleasant, rather aggressive individuals who you can see, you know, sort of the anger inside of them and the aggression inside of them. And that is exactly the opposite of what they should have done. And that's bunker or siege mentality that you can see there. That then translates, as you correctly said, to the country as a whole, can also be seen very often in the way that Israeli spokespeople reply to journalists on British TV or American television, right? Where, so instead of saying, we need to convince the British audience and the UK is a supporter of Israel at a foreign policy level, and the US is very much a supporter of Israel at a foreign policy level, we need to show British people and Americans that we're not monsters, that we don't like killing people, that it's just something that we feel we need to do, but we're just like them. Instead of that, you have spokesperson after spokesperson being incredibly belligerent, being incredibly aggressive, basically ostracizing any journalist that asks a critical question. How dare you ask a critical question? And that is very, very counterproductive.
Extremely. And I think there was a moment that encapsulates this the best. And this was a video published by the Israeli delegation. Of the singer, the Israeli artist, practicing her song, and her team basically booing at her and throwing pro-Palestine sentences at her, right? And you can clearly see by how they're doing it that they're kind of making fun of that, and that she's showing how she's preparing for this and how she's practicing for this. And that's incredibly arrogant. It's incredibly patronizing also, right, towards people who voice their support for Palestine here. I mean, right, aside from the fact, does it make sense to voice your criticism towards the state and the Israeli military towards a young woman who's performing at a song contest, right? Aside from the fact whether this makes sense or not, I'm not the judge here. But that video, I think I can judge, and that video came across as very arrogant and patronizing, and not what you should be doing, right? Not being humble and nice and very likable because you are trying to win over the middle. Again, you're not trying to win over your camp. You already have your camp on your side, but here you're trying to win over the middle, and I think you're failing at doing so.
And it seems to confirm the criticism, right? So if you're Israeli and you believe that your country and your government is doing the right thing, then at the very minimum, you need to understand that a lot of people around the world are uncomfortable because your military killed 30,000 civilians or 35,000 civilians. You need to be able to say to the world, I understand that. I understand that what we're doing is terrible. But the means justify the end, or however you want to put it. Instead of showing empathy for all those people who are saddened, outraged, angry that civilians are being killed, you're mocking them. And that is exactly the opposite of what you should be doing. And it, to me, and I think it's very important that you explained this 5 minutes ago, but to me, it shows that Israel has lost touch with the reality that the rest of the world lives in. That they can no longer understand how the rest of the world observes them, and they can no longer think practically about their own self-interest. It's in Israel's interest that the rest of the world empathizes with them. And in order to do that, you need to connect with concerns from the rest of the world.
Yeah. Balder, now you have to be strong, because this is the moment when we're going to talk about the Dutch delegation, or particularly the Dutch performer, because as we mentioned before, he was disqualified. And this came following an incident where there was an allegation of intimidation. Basically, so the Dutch performer intimidated a female member of the Eurovision production crew. And that this allegation was basically brought towards to the police. And following this allegation of intimidation, the Dutch performer was then disqualified from the competition and was not allowed to compete. Which, I mean, the optics of this are really bad from an institutional perspective, right? If you are the European Broadcasting Union, there is someone who is critical towards the Israeli delegation. There's someone who kind of, there was a bit, right? There's, again, we're not saying who was at the right or the wrong here. And suddenly that person is then disqualified following an allegation like this. And there's obviously very, very quickly a lot of conspiracies, right? Was this an, was he, I don't know, did he punch the Israeli artist, or was this a fight between the delegations? And this obviously fueled kind of anger during the day and made Eurovision even less enjoyable, because suddenly you have people, right, saying, okay, we should boycott this, we should not be participating. Other artists were really upset, and so on and so forth. And basically 24 hours before Eurovision takes place, it's a huge mess.
Yes, and I think we still don't know exactly all the details, because they haven't been published by the Swedish police and haven't been published by the EBU. But I think we can fairly state that the likely scenario is that he made a aggressive gesture against this camera woman, not the Israeli delegation. It was a camera woman who was filming him against his wishes. He asked her not to film him. She continued doing it. And he made an aggressive gesture against her. He, as far as we know, he didn't hit her. He didn't touch her. But he was aggressive in some way towards her. And, like, I mean, maybe images come out later and it looks horrible, you know. But in most cases, if someone makes an aggressive gesture, what then afterwards happens is that you say, oh, this was, I'm sorry, I was a little bit on edge. I apologize, I shouldn't have done that. Can I buy you a beer or something, right? That's the way to go about it. And instead, the EBU decided to escalate this very quickly. The Swedish police got involved, and the delegation got disqualified. Now, this in itself seems to me a case of the EBU shooting itself horribly in the foot. The Netherlands has been a key component of Eurovision since the very inception. Even though it's not one of the big five nations, the Netherlands is an important player in European politics. And now the Dutch, who were already very deeply connected to this song, are furious with the EBU and feel that they've been betrayed. And feel so. I find it very difficult to understand what happened in the EBU that they just didn't say, okay, please, Dutch delegation or Dutch singer, please apologize publicly, or if the camera woman would like a personal apology, you know, apologize to her personally, say that it was just a moment of tension after the rehearsals, and that's it. Why didn't the EBU let it go that way? Why did they escalate it that quickly? It seems a very tone deaf to do it in the way they did it. And as a result, they created enormous drama, completely unnecessary from my perspective, from what I can see.
Well, not only drama, but also real economic loss, right? So, I mean, the EBU is, of course, I mean, this is one of their, I mean, this is the biggest event that public broadcasting does in Europe each year. And before, you already had calls basically to boycott Eurovision because Israel was participating. After the disqualification of the Netherlands, this became more intense. And we can also see this in the numbers. So usually about 4 to 5 million people in the Netherlands watch Eurovision. And we saw that basically when Joost, so the Dutch performer, was still performing in the semi-final, 3 million people were still watching it. But the final, only 2 million people watched. As you said, you shoot yourself in the foot. I mean, on an institutional basis, because why are you causing difficulties? But you also, you just lost potentially 3 million people who were watching your program.
And who didn't phone in, or at least much fewer Dutch people phoned in. And that's also a source of revenue for the entire organization. And you basically opened the door to lawsuits, to their calls in the Netherlands to withdraw from the EBU altogether, not to participate next year. Now, when things calm down, maybe it won't become that drastic, but basically you're creating an awful lot of problems without any apparent gain. I don't understand what they got out of this escalation like this. You know, what was the benefits doing like that? And that is quite interesting from an institutional perspective that's no longer connects to the realities on the ground, right? It seems as if the EBU and the organizers in Sweden were not at all connected to the way that the large crowds of Eurovision fans were feeling about this situation and the broader situation relating to Israel, relating to the organization, etc., etc. Because it wasn't just the Dutch, but there were, you know, enormous outcries for banning or boycotting the event from other parts as well. And so it is a sign of institutions being completely disconnected from the reality that people face. And as such, I think it's interesting to, you know, use this as a case study.
Mm. And we don't have all the numbers yet from all the countries because it's, as I said, very, very recent. It just happened about 17 hours ago. But in the UK, about 25% fewer people tuned in to watch Eurovision yesterday. And so to summarize this a little bit, right, the bubble perspective, because I'm fascinated at how easy it is for us right now to apply the Western bubble concept to this individual cases of let's be honest, a ridiculous song contest where artists are just supposed to perform and sing, but they manage to turn this into international relations, right? And we clearly see that the Israeli delegation almost exactly behaved like the Israeli state. And I think it's incredible how easy that is to do. And it shows you very much why I think people didn't enjoy to watch Eurovision, because it became so incredibly political.
And how the EBU behaved exactly like a lot of European institutions are behaving, once again disconnected from the realities that Europeans are feeling, right? So we were actually going to talk about universities today before we decided to switch to Eurovision. And you see the same thing where it seems almost impossible at the moment for universities or political institutions to connect to the emotions and the feelings of the normal person in the streets who just goes about their daily business, but who feels completely unheard, who feels completely unrecognized by the powers that be, by the establishment. The EBU will have had, I would have loved to be a fly on the wall, but they had some kind of conversations about this and some kind of decision-making process that led to this escalation, completely disconnected from how the millions and millions of fans looked at this. And that is institutions shooting themselves in the foot. It's Israel shooting itself in the foot. And it seems as if they're incapable of understanding that. It's incapable of stepping outside of that bubble.
What's the international relations context?
Now that we've applied basically the Western bubble concept to an individual group, let's, in the international relations perspective, actually look at the international relations perspective of all of this. And so what we saw happening here with the Israeli delegation of basically, right, I mean, kind of focusing too much on the people who are already in their camp, losing track of the middle ground. We see the exact same happening to Israel because, and it's obviously right in our conversation right before this episode, you brought this up, how, I mean, Israel is now losing the middle ground. And I at first wanted to say, oh no, that's not the case, because, I mean, right, part of Eurovision is then the public vote where you phone in, and Israel actually got the second highest number of phone calls, which is obviously an incredible win for Israel in a way, given the very isolated event of Eurovision. But then you brought up, hey, compare this to the numbers of like of public support 6-7 months ago, when on October basically 8th, so one day after the attacks, most of the world stood with Israel and most of the public was very sympathetic towards Israel and it's in that moment actions and cause. But comparing those numbers to today, Israel has been doing terribly from a public relations perspective.
Yeah, and that's again that siege mentality that we mentioned earlier. So you rightfully said they focus very much on the ones that are already in their camp, that are already supporting them. But more worrying for Israel is that they are comfortable fighting those criticizing them. And the moment, so if simplistically, if you divide the population into three camps, you've got the ones who are just with you, who agree with what you're doing, who are will always support you. You've got those who will always criticize you, who believe that you are a evil regime, that you're an evil state. But then there is the big, big middle ground of, let's say, 90% of the population. And the moment that you as Israel start fighting that other side, start arguing with those who are against you, that 5% that no matter what will always hate you, then that middle ground of 90% of the population is going to look at you badly. They're going to say, oh, this is a bit ugly. I don't like you fighting these people. These are young students or these are young activists, and I might not agree with those activists, but please be kind towards each other. And the moment that you as Israel aggressively go after them, you lose a large segment of the population. You still have your core supporters. They like it. It's a little bit like Donald Trump, right? Donald Trump likes it when he says something outrageous. The Donald Trump supporters like it when Donald Trump says something outrageous about something, because Trump's right. Yeah, Trump, you say it as it is. Great for you. But most people look at that and think, oh, I don't think that's very comfortable. I would like you to be kind and nice and polite. And that's the same with Israel. And they seem to be so stuck in their siege mentality of, we are fighting the good fight, and anyone criticizing us is either anti-Semitic or is an idiot or anything like that. And so we want to win the word game as well. We want to win the juvenile little back and forth with you. And the result of that is that Israel is losing the middle ground, and they've lost it by now. And the fact that they didn't try to gain some ground there in the Eurovision contest, that they didn't say, hey, this is an opportunity for us to show that we are reasonable, kind, loving people, is a huge failure on the Israeli delegation side. And it's a huge failure by the Israeli government.
See, and one of the things I like so much about this segment in the international relations perspective is that we can take a step back. And you finished perfectly, because it's a huge failure on the side of the Israeli government. Because, I mean, yes, if we look back, the other side of the spectrum, right, so the pro-Palestinian side, is doing exactly the same mistakes. I mean, right, you're sitting down in universities and protesting. You maybe, like some of your chants might be very problematic. You might give basically refuge to some people who are actually anti-Semitic and chanting really problematic things. But that's, and ironically, I've learned this during my exchange in Israel, that's one of the problems with social movements, right? So social movements are really difficult to control. It's bottom up. You can, basically any idiot can join your camp and chant something, and you have to make the decision, oh, do I now want to kick someone out from the camp who is potentially supporting us, but he's saying problematic things? Yeah, so, I mean, I can criticize these students and the side of the spectrum that is very much anti-Israel. I can criticize them all day long, but they are ultimately a bunch of individuals and they are a social movement. But on the other side, when we're talking about the Israeli delegation and the Israeli government, we're talking about a government, right? A state government. And the fact that they are behaving like this and that they are falling so much into this Western bubble mindset, into this bunker and siege mentality, is incredibly problematic. And, I mean, might actually be damaging to them on the international stage. So not only talking about the masses, but, I mean, you already mentioned it, that some Dutch politicians are now feeling very uncomfortable about Eurovision. I mean, hey, here, we're talking about the lapdog of the West. I'm not sure how pro-Israel the Dutch government might be in the near future.
And this, for me, is, again, I mean, I think, let's put it like this. I'm not always comfortable with the position of the Dutch government, to put it mildly, as listeners will know. But the Dutch government and the Dutch people in general, there are exceptions, of course, have been much more than the global average on the side of Israel. the Netherlands has been consistently a supporter of Israel at a foreign policy level. After Germany and after the UK, perhaps, I would argue that the Netherlands has been the biggest supporter of Israel, even these past 6 months. And I have criticized that because I think that they've been way too supportive of Israel, but it's a fact that they were. And why in heaven's name would you, if you are Israel, alienate one of the main three allies that you have in Europe? Why would you make the Dutch people dislike you? Why would you take pleasure out of the Dutch Eurovision entry being excluded from the event, even if that individual singer, Joost Klein, says something unkind towards you or something you disagree with? Let it be, because the bigger fish is the Dutch population, is the 17, 18 million people living in the Netherlands who have been broadly helping you at a foreign policy level. And yet, again, from a very juvenile, in a very juvenile way, the Israelis seem to have taken pleasure out of this. Haha, we got Joost Klein disqualified. Well, congratulations for that little tiny minuscule victory that you seem to feel you've had. But you now are going to make it much less likely that the Dutch government will be supportive of you directly or within Europe. And that is a huge, huge problem if you're Israel. It is just so, so irrational.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
Talking about the damage, I think it makes sense here to start with the institutions and right more broadly speaking, because in the bubble part of this episode, we've been very focused on the Israeli delegation, we've been very focused on the EBU, then we kind of already took it up to the international relations level with the State of Israel. And now let's take it from the EBU to general institutions, because as you've mentioned already a few times, there's an increasing disconnect between institutions and the people. We see this in everyday life, but here with Eurovision, we have a clear-cut example how the EBU completely lost, I mean, its sense of what the people want and how they behave.
Yeah, the EBU at its core has basically one purpose: to provide entertainment to the European masses, right? That's why it exists. That's the purpose. It's mostly exclusively, at least technically, exclusively public institutions. So the profit motive is not even there for them, technically. Now, we know that these kinds of institutions do have an indirect profit motive, but technically their only purpose is to provide entertainment to the masses. And that means that you need to know what's going on with the masses, and you need to know what kind of behavior will cater to the masses. That's the way you're going to do your job. And it's completely obvious that the EBU has been fully disconnected from the masses. I mean, just if you followed social media, and I don't really have social media, but I was kind of almost, sarcastically following whatever I could on Reddit and on Twitter just to see what in heaven's name is going on here. Social media were completely clear about this. There was no sympathy whatsoever for the EBU, no sympathy for their stance on specific delegations, no sympathy for the disqualification of the Dutch delegation, and no sympathy for the general tone of the event yesterday. And so you have to ask yourself, how is that possible? How is an institution that is supposed to cater to the masses, is supposed to cater to providing fun entertainment to hundreds of millions of people potentially, not capable of doing that? And then the answer to that is very similar to the answer of why governments are so disconnected at the moment from populations. Namely, they live in their own institutional bubble. They have their own pressure points, their own contacts, their own sponsors, their own financial interests that make them go in a certain direction. And they no longer actually represent the general public.
And what now?
Let's look into the future, because this is a very nice setup for our next three episodes, right? The weakness and the increasing disconnection of institutions, particularly within the West. And we, right, so we wanted to do this actually today, but now we're going to do it next week and the next 3 weeks, where we will basically do a three-part a topic on institutions in general. And we will focus on first kind of like the educational aspect of this. So universities, you've teased this already before, on, okay, what are institutions doing? Are they becoming too political? Are they becoming too disconnected? So we will focus on universities first. Then we will look into foreign policy in basically episode in 2 weeks. And then lastly, we will finish this up with a more general touch and a conclusion. However, there's one more part I want to say about Eurovision, because I think this summarizes this year's Eurovision actually very well, because we haven't really talked about the results yet. I mean, if you ask me personally, I think it's an absolute crime that the French song and the French artist didn't win, but absolutely fantastic. But I think in such a politicized year, there was only one winner, right, that anyone could think of. And right, if you don't want to vote pro-Israel or against Israel, you don't want to be for or against the Netherlands, then let's just go with the most neutral country, and that's Switzerland. And Switzerland actually won. And I think that is very representative of that zeitgeist right now, because I think that the West people in general, right, populations are longing for some boring stability, right? Enough with pandemics and wars left and right. I just want to have a few years without a crisis, please.
Yeah, I think that is fair. There's this enormous confusion, and people are fed up with the confusion, right? Confusion about the world, confusion about who we are in the West, what the West is supposed to do, how we deal with all these crises, how we deal with the violence that we are partially responsible for. It's very, very clear that people are longing for just escaping, longing to escape this kind of continuous crisis environment. Having said that, European populations, Western populations, are also contributing to it, right? With their anger, with their social media bubbles, with their echo chamber. So on the one hand, it's kind of like, let's vote for Switzerland because that is safe. And, you know, we don't have to worry about politics because that's what we want. On the other hand, let's also tweet out our anger. Let's also go on Reddit and debate why we are right and they are wrong, why we are on the good side of history and they're on the wrong side of history. So it's like a weird paradox of behavior, longing for stability, longing for neutrality of Switzerland. And on the other hand, continuously engaging in anger and emotions and taking positions and judging others. And I think that conflict is something that might at some point break up the West, right? No longer knowing who we want to be and almost schizophrenically being torn apart by this. And even though this was just a song contest, just a silly event once a year that people really shouldn't care too much about, it has been a very good case study of a troubled future that the West is facing.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on how Eurovision captures the current Western zeitgeist. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it for my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
A little bit of an unusual quote. If you go through the list of all the people we've quoted so far, this one definitely stands out. This is a former winner, Austrian winner of Eurovision, Conchita Wurst, and she said, "Eurovision is the bubble of inclusivity and respect, and it's so beautiful. If only the whole world would be in this bubble. It is a family that will never forget about you."